It's the 9th Noon Show on Highland Radio. You're welcome to the second hour of the programme. Some of your comments before we go any further. We were discussing home insurance in the first hour, and a caller says, it's not that people have no insurance, it's that they can't afford it. And most people in Donegal with defective blocks in their homes can't get home insurance. Another caller says, I was shocked to see at the weekend the level of underage drinking happening in a bar. Also people in the middle of bars vaping. Who is checking this? On the issue of Joe Biden in country pubs, Katrina says, I think it was lovely to see President Joe Biden in the country pubs. Pubs like these are not just for drinking. They're a community centre, a tourist office for many. These establishments are at the heart of the community. Another caller says, I'm baffled with all this Joe Biden hype and the madness to find Donegal and Irish connections. All this second cousins once removed carry-on is nonsense. I don't even know my own second cousins. I can't understand why Ireland loves all this attention. It's not news. Sick of seeing him in the newspapers. Another caller says, I had my house insurance for over 40 years and never had a claim. I assumed house insurance covered everything. A neighbour built a garage and didn't build a retaining wall to protect my home. Fear of a potential landslide, I rang the insurance company. An insurance adjuster came out to view the area in January. I hadn't heard back until yesterday morning. They told me in event of a potential landslide or damage to my street, I wouldn't be protected under my home insurance. No cover whatsoever. Listeners should be aware of this and know your policies and know your rights, so says a caller. This is the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio. Before the news at 10 o'clock, we had a discussion with Brendan Byrne of the Irish Fish Processors and Exporters Association concerned at the potential of offshore wind energy off the Donegal coast and the potential impact that would have on the spawning of fish and the availability of fish stocks. Also, the general impact it would have on the inshore fishing sector. Joined on Zoom now by Justin Moran, who is the Director of External Affairs with Wind Energy Ireland. Justin, good morning to you.
Good morning, Donald. Thank you so much for having me on.
It is our pleasure. Justin, we know that there is offshore wind energy at present being generated off Arklow in County Wicklow. That's the only offshore wind energy plant of Ireland that I'm aware of at this point in time. Looking at the maps that are being produced and the areas that have been set aside, that could change radically in the coming years. What is the plan, as you understand it first, for that level of development? And when will we actually see these aspirational zones actually turn into developments, as it were?
No, you're spot on, Donald. The only offshore wind farm we have operating at the moment is off the coast of Arklow in County Wicklow, and that was built almost 20 years ago, so it's quite an old wind farm now at this stage. At the end of this month, the first group of new wind farms will compete against each other in an auction for a contract from the government, and then the successful ones will apply for planning permission before the end of the year. So that's five projects off the east coast of Ireland, from Louth, North Dublin to Wicklow, and then one project off the west coast in Galway. After that, we expect the second group of projects to start to roll out, starting initially with the south coast of Ireland and then expanding around the east coast and the west coast, and then obviously hopefully off the coast of Donegal as well at some point. We're not expecting to see construction start until hopefully, and it depends how long they will be in the planning process, but hopefully construction starting in 2026 with the first new wind farms operational, generating electricity, providing power to Irish consumers, probably in 2028, 2029.
Now, judging by those figures, we're probably realistically looking well into the 2030s then before there are actually functioning operational wind farms off the Donegal coast. Between now and then, how much consultation is there going to be? How much is there going to be the facility for local communities and for fishers in particular to actually have their input into the process?
Well, I think that input is happening already. So Wind Energy Ireland is part of a working group that's been set up by government. It includes ourselves, but it also includes 17 different fishing organisations, fish producer organisations, organisations like Bordís Giwara. And we meet on a monthly basis to try and figure out how we can ensure that the voice of fishermen is heard as early as possible, not just for individual projects, Donald, not just talking about individual wind farms, but even before that, when we get to how policy is set, when we get to how areas of Ireland's waters, which would be suitable for wind farms, are identified, fishermen need to be involved at that stage of the process rather than even just waiting for the individual projects to roll forward. When we get to that point of individual projects, they absolutely need to be engaging as quickly as possible and as early as possible with the fishing community, but also with coastal communities more general. And not just to talk about the challenges, and there will be challenges in terms of developing infrastructure, but also the opportunities. I mean, those ports, those projects that will be competing in an auction later on this month off the east coast of Ireland, each one of those needs an operations and maintenance base. each operations and maintenance base is between 80 and 100 full-time jobs, and we're going to need people there who have marine experience. We need to know people there who know the local waters. So there'll be huge opportunities for people where those wind farms are built as well.
Okay, and I'm sure there's going to be people in places like Killybegs or Greencastle or indeed Burton Port who will be thinking, yeah, there's potentially going to be business for us down the line here as well. But there remains, it seems to me, there are going to be competing perspectives here. On the one hand, we have the fish processors telling us that given the level of potential displacement you have, they want to see turbine developments go much further out to sea. They want to see them 50 kilometres, 80 kilometres plus out to sea because of the potential impact it can have on spawning. From the point of view of your members who will be building the wind farms, they want them as close to shore as possible because the closer they are to shore, the cheaper it is to maintain them, the cheaper it's going to be to maintain connections, and the cheaper it's going to be to service them. So you're going to have that competing perspective. The fishers are going to want them as far away as possible. Your members are going to want them as close as possible. There's going to be a huge gap there to be bridged.
Well, I mean, you're absolutely right. The cheaper that we can produce electricity, the cheaper we can produce power for Irish consumers, and the more we can do to try and reduce the exorbitantly high electricity prices that your listeners are already paying at the moment. So the more inexpensive we can produce electricity, the better for everyone. But I suppose going back to the point about trying to find a way to coexist, we have two critical national priorities. We need to develop renewable energy to cut our carbon emissions and to achieve energy independence. At the same time, an equally important national priority is the preservation, hopefully the expansion of our fishing industry, because it's absolutely critical to Ireland's food security. So what's happening at the moment, your listeners might be aware, there's a consultation going on regarding the offshore renewable energy development plan. So this is happening at the moment. I think there was actually a meeting in Killybegs about it not too long ago. Mm-hmm. And this is an opportunity for people from our industry and people from the seafood industry and people from other industries as well, by the way. People might use Irish waters for leisure activity or for transport or for travel or for things like that, to sit down and go, well, okay, where is a good place to build a wind farm? Where is a bad place to build a wind farm? And let's try and develop a plan that ensures we can develop the offshore wind energy we critically need, while at the same time protecting and enhancing our fishing industry.
Part of the problem is always going to be, and I can imagine a lot of our listeners, you know, and the comments are going to start coming in fairly, fairly shortly, I would imagine. And here's what I foresee will start coming in. That there's going to be people in, with all due respect to people in Dublin, there'll be people in Dublin making decisions based on priorities, the need for renewable energy, the need to protect the environment, the need for keeping costs as low as possible, absolutely laudable, they make absolute sense. But there are people in Dublin going to be making decisions that know nothing about the fishing sector in West Donegal, they know nothing about the fishing sector in North Donegal, whereas in Donegal, everyone in this county knows people involved in the fishing industry. Everyone in this county knows people who are involved in that sector. Everyone in this county knows people who are going to be concerned about this. And every time they hear talk about we need to keep energy as cheap as possible, we need to keep it as renewable as possible, the three words in everyone's mind are going to be, at what cost?
Donald, I freely admit that I live in Dublin, but I'm a very proud Galway man, born and reared there. So I'll just note that at the very beginning. And you're absolutely right that there's parts of the country, and it's not just Donegal, but parts of Cork, parts of Kerry, parts of Mayo and Galway, where the fishing industry is an integral part of the community and it's an integral part of the local economy. And we're very, very cognizant of that. But if you look at wind farms that have been developed in other countries, in many cases, the fishing industry coexists with that. I literally, just before I came on air, I was looking at a video of an offshore wind farm in Grimsby, and you can literally see the fishing boats within 100, 200 metres of individual turbines collecting pots, carrying out fishing activity. So what we want to try and do is to find a way to coexist. And if there's issues of where we might just end up in that situation where we want to do one thing and the fish community wants to do the other, let's sit down together and try and thrash it out. And I think that's why the working group, where, by the way, the fishing industry representatives are very strongly articulating the views of their members, and I think that should be acknowledged. That's why setting up that working group is so important, so we can start to have the discussions now about wind farms that might not be built for 10 years, but let's start talking now about the policies we're going to put in place and how we're going to ensure that whatever impact we have on the fishing sector is minimised, but also that we find opportunities for the fishing sector from the development of offshore renewable energy.
Have seismic studies been done in these areas? Because one of our callers is saying, we were talking years ago about investing in windmills and specifically around the area of Mulroy Bay, but we were told that because there's an earthquake line close by, windmills would be unsuited. How come now they can be built on the coast and there is no mention of this earthquake line that was spoken about in the past. So, I mean, one would presume there would have to been seismic studies done and sort of studies of the ground and the seabed to assess the suitability of this area. To what extent has that been a feature or has that been done yet?
I wouldn't be able to comment on that specific project because I don't know whether those surveys have been carried out in that area. But certainly, if you're looking to develop an offshore wind farm, you will be carrying out years of geophysical and geotechnical surveys to thoroughly map the seabed. You would also be looking to get the kind of local expertise that your listener just rang in there with. The people who know the coast of Donegal the best are not living in Dublin. They're not even living in Galway, Donal. They're living in Donegal. And that's why when the community engagement process begins, it's so important that people share their expertise, share their knowledge and tell us, actually, no, you shouldn't build there. And here's why you shouldn't build there. And we know this because we're familiar with these waters. And that needs to be taken into account. I think it's also really important to note every one of these projects will have to go through a full planning permission, full planning application. So people will have the opportunities not just to engage with the projects and sit down across the table from the developers, whether it's the fishing industry or local people. But if the project goes forward, they'll have the opportunity to be part of the planning process and put in their concerns and objections and ensure that they're listened to.
One of the reasons we're speaking to you today is it does so happen that you are in the news today, but you're in the news because you're expressing concern at the fact that many ports in this country aren't at this point equipped to actually cater for developments like this into the future at Belfast. Belfast, the only port at the moment capable of facilitating such constructions. Now, if this construction work is going to be on, presumably you're going to be looking towards ports like Killybegs, potentially Burtonport, Greencastle et al., to actually be working on and helping in the process of developing, maintaining and servicing these installations. Presumably you'd be speaking to people in those ports and saying, look, there's huge opportunities here.
Absolutely, we have. And in fact, we published a report last September that the National Port Study in Killybegs is one of the ports that was analysed and examined for how it could be used to support both the construction and then once they're up and running, the operations and maintenance for these wind farms. But you're absolutely right with the challenge that we have. We want to build Irish wind farms from Irish ports. And right now, we only have a single port on the island that can be used to do that. If we're trying to build more than one wind farm at the same time, you can't use the same port for the same project. The infrastructure demands are too big. The other concern we'd have is there's no reason that Belfast is going to be sitting around waiting to take our jobs. They're going to be looking at British offshore wind farms will be built in the Irish Sea as well. So what we want to see is investment in ports to ensure that Irish ports are building Irish offshore wind farms and that we're creating jobs in places like Cork and Limerick and Donegal and not places like Britain and Wales and France.
Caller is saying there have been mistakes made in Donegal, turbines on peat bogs. There's not enough land in Ireland or coast around the country to power Ireland by 70%. It's nonsense pushed by profiteers. If it wasn't for the subsidies, there'd be no planning applications. And we know certainly there was the issue with Mean Bog, which I'm sure you're familiar with in recent years. And people are looking at that and they're saying, look, mistakes have been made on land. We've seen incidents on land. If we have incidents at sea, it could be potentially catastrophic.
I suppose just to say, first of all, we have more than enough electricity to meet, wind energy electricity to meet well beyond the 70% target. And between wind, solar and other renewable technologies, we can have a zero carbon electricity system in Ireland, probably sometime between 2035 and 2040. And that's not me saying it as somebody who's representing the wind energy industry. You can speak to any energy policy expert. You can speak to any energy company working in Ireland. They'll tell you the same thing. And I think what we want to try and do is avoid any mistakes that have been made in the past, either onshore or offshore, and to learn from those experiences. So that goes back to, I suppose, the point that I was making earlier. The more we can hear from local communities when we're trying to develop these projects, the more we can benefit from that local expertise and ensure that these projects are sited in the most sustainable way possible to generate the electricity that we need to push down the price for electricity consumers, to cut our carbon emissions and to end our dependency on imported fossil fuels. Donal, we're spending €1 million an hour buying fossil fuels into this country to power Ireland. Let's try and find a different way of doing it and let's try and keep that money at home.
Justin Moran, thank you very much indeed for speaking to us this morning. That's Justin Moran there, who's the Director of External Affairs with Wind Energy Ireland. Justin, thank you. And we will move on. Let's take a few more. Before we take comments, actually, let's go to the lines because, as we said, the inshore fishing sector is going to be very much affected by this. Let's go to line one and speak to Liam. Liam, good morning.
Good morning, Donal.
Liam, you are a member of the inshore fishing community in Donegal. What's your take on this whole discussion? We've heard from Brendan Byrne and now we've just heard from Wind Energy Ireland.
Well, if you look at the overall proposals on all the maps around Ireland, you think Oliver Cromwell was back, ceased multinationals and ocean grabbing, World Bank's involved in it. It's going to wipe out the whole inshore fishing community and Inishowen, because we have a good potting history right around the old Donegal coast. I would say that one of the best crab you'd get is in the northwest. Along the Donegal coast, there's a lot of inshore fishermen and all the harbours right around, right down to Mayo, depend on that fishery. It's a part of our heritage. And it's the one farms is one thing, but the grid lines come in and then they stay exclusion zones. Like that, he talks about your last caller there was talking about Grimsby and that there. It's a gesture fishing what they have. They don't have the full potential of what they had fishing. It's a gesture fishing they got.
Yeah.
And you're not allowed. And I was speaking to one little personnel at a meeting in Killybegs. You're only allowed one single pot. One single pot, not a train of pots, or we call it tow of pots, a line of pots on the around the grid lines. There's no thing there. No, there's cost. We have a group supposed to be called RIF. They're supposed to represent us. We feel they're not representing us. We feel that they're sitting on deaf ears. They're not stepping up to the mark. We have young men. The youngest of the men now is in their 25s. Now, normally it would be in their 18s,
yeah.
17, 18, 16, going into the fishery school. That's not happening. We're gonna lose our young men by that, because they're going to get fed up and go to other jobs. And it's hard to get cruising boats now at the moment. I know there's more options now for fishing. Yeah. But we see where I'd be going to the Irish Sea last year. We were down fishing, and all our grounds the whole way down, our prong grounds down the whole East Coast, has been all earmarked right down. It's been earmarked for proposals for windmills. It's going to wipe out the whole inshore sector, even the larger vessels and the prawns and the Irish Sea. It's going to wipe out them too.
Justin there from Energy Ireland was telling us that there's going to be more consultation, there's going to be planning processes, and there is consultation at the moment. Now you're saying the consultation that's taken place so far, you don't have confidence in it. Based on what you're saying to me, I don't get any sense that you have confidence in any future consultation either.
Like, Donald, we had a gas line pipeline run out across the Irish Sea. We're told that anybody had their gear obstructed or damaged or lost, and they'd be compensated for it. If that's different, the gas line is supposed to sink onto the ground with a salty bottom. It didn't happen. Men lost their gear, they were never compensated for it. Once they get their foot on the door, and I know people within the communities around here would sell you out on that case for windmills. It's a part of way of life. We know nothing else. We're hunters. We know nothing else. And the young men's in it. We're trying to keep them in it. And if this comes in, I know a lot of them invested heavy in pots and yeah, in boats and that. They'll have to sell up. We know in Arklow, we know this causes heat exchange on the bottom with the current, with the grid lines. The crab mightn't move over them. The fish mightn't go near them either with the noise of the electricity going through the lines. I don't think there's enough science. Anything we had asked about the science, they were failing to tell us on the science. They don't seem to be well up in it. But we seem to be going to be the sacrificial lamb for these windmills.
Yeah.
And we see there where a lot of our young people are emigrating there now. And we're trying to keep our culture going here.
Well, Liam, we're obviously going to keep a very close eye. Yeah, Liam, we're obviously going to keep a very close eye on what's happening. And you know, we'll be speaking to yourselves and to the reps. There's certainly years of talking to come. Sorry, you just wanted to make one final point there, because
at the moment there'll be certain acoustic surveys and that there in the northwest. Now, to will only show fishermen, the crabmen, says they are not removing their gear for anybody. Because they felt that they're being led up the garden path. They're going to stay to their fishing grounds. They're not leaving their fishing grounds on to whatever time. There's a proper consultation. The science comes out, shows the fishermen that it's not going to threaten their livelihoods.
Liam, as I say, we'll be monitoring with interest, and there's a lot more talk and a lot more discussion to come for the moment. Liam, thank you very much indeed. That's Liam there, a member of the inshore fishing community in North Donegal. We're going to take a short break. We'll be discussing the Good Friday Agreement and people's attitudes to it 25 years on after this. This week has seen a lot of coverage of the Good Friday Agreement. Earlier this week, the agreement was 25 years old. A lot's happened since then, and a new research paper has just been published, Political Attitudes in Northern Ireland After Brexit and Under the Protocol. One of the authors of that piece of research is Professor Katie Hayward, who's the Professor of Political Sociology at Queen's in Belfast, and she joins us on Zoom. Katie, good morning to you.
Morning, Donal. Thanks for having me on.
It is our pleasure. It's obviously an awful lot of talk about the Good Friday Agreement in the context of Stormont, obviously the protocol, and also in the context of the fact that Joe Biden is on the island at the moment. He was in Belfast yesterday, having flown in on Tuesday night, made a speech at, well, we won't say which university he made the speech at. We'll just gloss over that one, shall we? But there's obviously an awful lot of focus on the agreement at the moment. And the findings of your research would suggest that 25 years on, there is still a lot of support for it within Northern Ireland.
Yes, I should say I'm a graduate of McGee, so it was fine to be in Ulster University. And indeed, this Northern Ireland Life and Times survey is a joint initiative between Ulster University and Queen's. So we run this social attitude survey every year. And part of that attitude survey includes questions about political attitudes, about identity, about constitutional futures, and about the Good Friday Belfast Agreement. We released the political results early because, as you say, this is a very significant week for looking at the Good Friday Agreement. And it's quite clear that it enjoys the support of a vast majority of people in Northern Ireland as the best basis for governing Northern Ireland. So 7 out of 10 people say, yes, it's good for Northern Ireland. However, what has changed is that in recent times we've seen a growing proportion of our respondents saying that they think it needs reform. So now 55% of people are saying that it does need reform in some way. And we still see just a very low proportion of about 16% saying that it needs to be removed altogether.
One of the things that I think in one way surprised me, and maybe in another way didn't surprise me, is that under 35s are less likely to have a positive view of the agreement. Now, is that because the older you are, the more you remember about what happened in the late 60s and the 70s and the 80s and the 90s? And for young people now, and I have spoken to young people, you know, who are in Derry and Tyrone and so on, which we would border here in Donegal, and they have almost no conception about what it used to be like. I mean, the Camel's Hump checkpoint, which used to lie between Strabane and Lifford, came up for discussion one day, and a person that lives in Strabane was in the, and said, and the question was, where was that? And to my mind, the idea of someone from Strabane not knowing where the Camel's Hump was sort of quite a surprise. And maybe now, because of that distance, people don't necessarily appreciate what went before.
I think that's definitely a factor. So, yeah, as you say, under 35s are less likely to have a positive view about the agreement. And that's partly because they're much more likely to say that they don't know. And on the under 24s in particular, we see them saying, yes, it's good, but it needs substantial reform. And we don't know, because this is quantitative data, we don't know why people are saying that. But I teach in Queen's, and judging by what I gather from my students, as you say, there is this sense of thankfully not having experienced the conflict, but also a sense, yes, they've heard about the Good Friday Belfast Agreement, but they don't necessarily know what it entails or why it was quite so significant. And also, of course, they are living with the consequences of us not having democratic institutions properly functioning at the moment. So they associate quite a bit of the agreement with actually a hiatus rather than properly functioning democracy. And hence, I think that wish to see reform, which is in some ways quite understandable.
Is that I mean, when they say they want reform, are they looking for, say, the dismantling of the De Hunt system, which is a very, very precise mathematical way of governing how Stormont works, and has left us in the situation where if one party chooses not to participate in the vote to elect a speaker, then a speaker is not elected and Stormont can't function. That maybe the issue is that the De Hunt system, it's very, very precise and it's very, very inclusive, but it's so inclusive that one misstep and the whole thing collapses.
Yes. So we asked in the 2021 survey, if you want to see reform to the Good Friday Agreement, what sort of reform would you like to see? And we gave them a set of issues that seemed to be unresolved or contentious at the moment. And the things that most people wanted to see changed was actually things that were there originally in 1998 and that we haven't seen fully implemented. So that includes the Bill of Rights and that includes the Civic Forum, which collapsed in 2002. So that sort of direct engagement with wider civic society and issues around the Good Friday Belfast Agreement that aren't necessarily associated with unionist and nationalist, that's what people, clear majority of people would like to see. Then we do see that there's less support for now, we didn't ask specifically about De Hunt, but we did ask about mandatory coalition and about the fact that key decisions in the Assembly are taken on a cross-community vote, i.e. with a certain proportion needed of unionist and nationalist MLAs supporting something, and those who are designated as other aren't counted in that calculation. And we do see, yes, a majority of people would like to see adjustment on that too. That's possibly reflecting something else that we find in the Northern Ireland Life and Times survey, which is that the plurality of people, so most people, identify as neither unionist nor nationalist. That's not just amongst younger people, but it's particularly true for them.
Brexit, I'm sure, has had a huge impact on this, not least because of the protocol and all the political debate about the relationships north and south, the relationships east and west, and also the relationships UK and Europe, because you've got sort of three potentially very complex sets of relationships, and the protocol and other elements of the what was called at the time the divorce deal, trying to straddle all those various different priorities. How big an impact has Brexit had on perceptions of the GFA? Because one would have thought, you know, at this point in time, probably Brexit, more so than the Good Friday Agreement, is what's exerting most political influence on thought in Northern Ireland.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So, of course, Brexit puts pressure on all three strands of the agreement, on the UK-Irish relationship, on North-South relations on the island. There's a lot of concern, of course, about what it means for the border and for North-South cooperation, and between relations within Northern Ireland, given that the majority of unionists voted to leave, a small majority, but a majority, and the vast majority of nationalists voted to remain. So, of course, it's put pressure on things. What we've seen really interestingly in the Northern Ireland Life and Times survey, we've asked a question since 2016, does Brexit make United Ireland more likely? And does it make you more in favour of United Ireland? And particularly since the protocol was signed in 2019, we've seen a significant trend since then, which is that a majority of people, so 63% of people, say Brexit makes United Ireland more likely. What's really interesting there is that includes a plurality of unionists as well as others, nationalists. And then in terms of does it make you more in favour of United Ireland? Unsurprisingly, perhaps nationalists, absolutely so. And amongst unionists, they say it makes no difference to their views. In fact, we've seen a rise in number of unionists saying it makes them more opposed to Irish unification. And then amongst those who are neither unionists nor nationalists, we see a really interesting shift. And that is that now the plurality of them say that Brexit makes them more in favour of a United Ireland. Now, we still see, and the bigger question, long-term future for Northern Ireland, how would you vote in a border poll? We still see the plurality of people saying Northern Ireland's future long-term should involve devolution in the UK, but that's a definite trend in expectation of Irish unification and in growing support for it.
How often does the survey get taken? Because it would be fascinating to compare figures in 10 years' time to figures from 10 years ago. Because I think it probably at this point in time, it's almost, and it seems strange given that the vote was 2016, but it's still always given how current the discussion of the protocol is, it's probably too early to assess the overall impact of Brexit on this. So it's going to take maybe another 10 years before we see the full impact of Brexit, and hopefully over the next couple of years we'll see the protocol debates put to bed, and we'll see some form of long-term relationship between North and South, between East and West, and between these islands and Europe develop. And it's going to take a lot of time before we can fully get through that process.
Yes, so you touched on a really important thing there, and that is about what Brexit and the protocol and the unique arrangements for Northern Ireland mean longer term. And it has implications legally, economically, politically, and perhaps culturally and socially as well. And we're only at the beginning of that process. So although we can see now, and this is a really interesting finding from the Life and Times survey, for the first time, more people expect to see United Ireland in 20 years than to see the United Kingdom exist. So that's a significant change. That's 20 years we're asking about. What happens in between? And we know that Northern Ireland's position is one that has changed, and its relationships with the rest of Ireland and with the rest of the United Kingdom have changed in all those real terms. And so there is a challenge for our political leaders, including in the Irish government, as well as the political parties in Northern Ireland, to handle this carefully, because there's this sense of these are real challenges of complexity. It's not just about identity. It's about changing Northern Ireland's managing these challenges in serious ways with longer term thinking. And so, yeah, even though these are polls on opinions and expectations, day to day, there's going to be differences that need to be managed in a sort of responsible way, and in a way that brings as much stability and predictability as possible.
Professor Katie Hayward, Professor of Political Sociology at Queen's in Belfast and graduate of McGee College in Derry. Thanks very much indeed for speaking to us this morning. That was a really good conversation there, and a lot of food for thought. And we'll be keeping an eye on future findings with great interest. Katie, thank you very much indeed. Quick comment. Cora says, now that President Biden, perhaps the world's most famous pro-choice advocate, is being welcomed with open arms by Ireland's clergy to Knock Shrine for Mass, is this a sign that the church is relaxing its opposition to abortion and possibly same-sex marriage in the future? I think that is somewhat of a leap, but we'll wait and see what happens. Now, Inishowen Co-op is celebrating its 60th anniversary in business this year, and it's holding a showcase for people who are extending, improving or decorating their home. It takes place in the Inishowen Gateway Hotel in Buncrana on Saturday. And I'm delighted to be joined on the line by Garth Whitmore, who is the General Manager of Inishowen Co-op. Garth, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Very well indeed. Garth, 60 years of operation. A lot has happened in Inishowen since 1963, and Inishowen Co-op has been at the heart of much of it.
Yes, over the last 60 years, they've started out in Carndonagh. We now have stores in Carndonagh, Moville, Buncrana, Nimavady and Sligo, as well as a meal manufacturer in Newton Cunningham. So over the last 60 years, the landscape has certainly changed.
In terms of the work the co-op does, it's got a network of shops, but it's much more than that. It's much more than just a retail chain. People will know the shops, obviously, and they'll know the front-facing offices, but there is way more to it than that.
Oh, we're very, very much community-focused. We are always there and have always been there for our community, and frankly, and hard our community as much as we can within the showing. The farming landscape has changed in that time, as have other landscapes in terms of business and tourism and everything else that goes along with it, and what we can do in Inishowen for the community. And we try to do as much as we can for community, and we're very, very appreciative of the support we get from our community in Inishowen.
The event that's taking place on this coming Saturday at the Inishowen Gateway in Buncrana, it's a home build exhibition. Tell us about what people can expect when they go there.
Well, the exhibition is on from 11 to 5 on Saturday, as you see, in the Inishowen Gateway. We have 40 exhibitors, so people are any stage of building a house or undertaking an improvement project, and to come along and discuss their plans or get some information on the products they're going to use from suppliers such as Tegrill and Quinns, Isovore, Canadia Flooring, Waterford Stanley. We also have, I suppose, emerging and established build materials such as concrete, the traditional concrete block. We have exhibitors for that. We have Stephen Logue, who undertakes ICF, that's insulated concrete formwork buildings. Darren Foy from Modern Timber Frames is at the show as well. We have Efficient Renewables in terms of solar, as well as Brendan Donaghy for retrofits, and everything in between from paint and Tobermore for patios, and our own stands there for white goods and barbecues and garden furniture. So overall, there's 40 exhibitors covering everything from roofs the whole way down to groundwork. And everything in between.
Obviously, anything of this nature happening in Inishowen cannot happen in isolation from the ongoing debate and discussion on defective blocks. And with that in mind, the MICA Action Group, very much one of your community partners in this event.
Yes, they are undertaking a discussion and talk to give our community and anyone else that wants to come along and get some information on where the scheme is at or get some questions that they need answered. They will be there at the exhibition and they'll have a discussion and a presentation at 1 o'clock in the hotel.
And that's potentially a very important one. Other community people involved as well, people like Spriaga Sport and Carndonagh, who are playing a huge role at the moment in the regeneration and upgrading of Carn, as it were.
Yes, they're very much community focused as well and big partners of ours, and we do a lot of work with them. Others invited and will be in attendance is the Credit Union, Inishowen Development Partnership, Inishowen Insights, and the Guards.
In terms of the future for Inishowen Co-op, Garth, what more do you have in terms of plans for the future? Because obviously, 60 years, very, very important role in the community. I'm sure you have plans looking toward the next 60 and more.
We have plans at the minute, yes. We're looking at a few different things. We have diversified a wee bit in the last few months, and we're looking at other opportunities within Inishowen to try and diversify a bit more. We want to support our farmers over the next number of years as the farming landscape changes with new regulations and changes that are being brought forward by discussions around climate change. We certainly want to be there. We will be there. We will discuss and help them as much as we can going forward.
Garth Whitmore, General Manager of the Inishowen Co-op, thanks indeed for speaking to us this morning.
Thank you very much for your time.
It's our pleasure. And we wish you all the best with the event. That's Garth there in Inishowen. Now, it's just 1 month until Alzheimer's Tea Day, and the ASI, Alzheimer's Society of Ireland, and Ambassadors Brian Murray and Una Crawford O'Brien are urging people in Donegal to participate on Thursday, May the 4th. Delighted to say that on Zoom, I'm joined by Hugh O'Donoghue, who is the Alzheimer's Societies of Ireland Communications Manager. Hugh, good morning.
Good morning.
Pleasure to speak to you, Hugh. Hugh, it's come to the point where designated days like this have very much become almost key points of any charitable organisation's day and year in terms of fundraising, and this has become a very important one for yourselves.
Yes, it has. You know, Tea Day is our largest and most important fundraiser, and we're now in our 29th year, so we're coming up on a very important milestone next year for our 30th, and, you know, this year, we're hoping to raise 300,000, and these vital funds will provide supports and services to people all over the country and in Donegal too.
Now, Tea Day is an important one because it serves two functions, really. It does serve the function of raising money, which is obviously vital for the ongoing continuation of your work. But there is also that underlying issue of communication. And one of the things that ASI is always pushing is the importance of communication, the importance of chat, the importance of sitting down over a cup of tea. I mean, what more Irish thing could there be to do than sit down for half an hour with a cup of tea and have a natter? And that is something you really, really want to encourage.
Of course, you know, and it's all about bringing people together and, you know, getting together with your friends, your families, your co-workers. You can have tea days wherever you like. Now, I've heard anecdotally of people having tea days up in the mountains or in the hills or the parks. So you can do it wherever. I mean, it's easy enough to fill up a flask and bring that out in a boat. So whatever you like.
Absolutely, because you're supporting people who are living with Alzheimer's and also, of course, supporting those who are caring for people who are living with Alzheimer's. And one of the things you're always promoting there is communication between them as well. And the worst thing we could possibly do when we're dealing with someone that has Alzheimer's is sort of do the safest thing to do is to say nothing. So I'll just retreat back and just leave them sit there with their thoughts. That's obviously not what we should be doing. We need to be communicating. We need to be sitting down. We need to be sharing as much as possible.
That's true, you know, and communicating helps to reduce the stigma around any condition or any kind of social situation. So, you know, we do encourage people to talk about it. And if they go onto our website and alzheimer.ie, there's loads of resources there that help you to talk about dementia and Alzheimer's to your friends and family.
Now, Brian Murray, the ambassador, powerful actor, people will know him right back from his days in the Irish RM through Hollyoaks and everything else he's done as well at home and abroad. Brian Murray himself was diagnosed with Alzheimer's 3 years ago. I heard him actually on Arena on RTE1 recently, speaking about how he's currently taking part in a play in Dublin, a part written specifically for him that allows him actually read his lines on stage, and has created this role where his Alzheimer's is part of the role, but he's now also able to act because he can't remember lines anymore. But it's okay because this has been created for him that's actually allowed him stay on a theatre stage in a specially constructed environment.
Yes, and of course we celebrate that. You know, Deirdre Kinahan wrote the play specifically with Brian in mind. And to the best of my knowledge, this is the first dementia-inclusive performance of a play worldwide. So it's quite groundbreaking in that sense. And, you know, the Alzheimer's Society of Ireland, we're all about people living as long in their community as possible. And, you know, initiatives like this allow Brian to continue doing what he loves, which is acting. And we're very happy to see as well that the play is now sold out. So he's doing a sold out run at the Abbey. So he may be the first actor with Alzheimer's disease to sell out a show in the Abbey. So that's amazing. You know, it's really gratifying for us to see.
And obviously we can't necessarily replicate something that big in our own communities, but maybe we can replicate them in our own homes, that if we have someone with Alzheimer's, we're always told perhaps, you know, play music that they would have listened to, take part in an activity, watch something on TV that they would have enjoyed, and try and bridge those links and get into their space as much as possible and find a space that can be shared where people can communicate.
Well, that's it. You know, it's all about finding joy, because there is a lot of joy to be found in every situation. So it is doing things like that, doing things the person would enjoy, be that music, playing music. Playing music is hugely important and helpful for people living with dementia. And if they can't, of course, they can listen to music too.
Hugh O'Donoghue, Communications Manager with Alzheimer's Society of Ireland, thank you very much indeed for speaking to us this morning. Just to remind people, Thursday, May 4th is Alzheimer's National Tea Day. You're asking people to get involved, go online, look it up, get the appropriate packs, and if you can raise a few quid, all the better.
Thank you so much.
It's our pleasure. Hugh, thank you very much indeed. That's Hugh there. And as we say, that day is taking place on Thursday, the 4th of May, which is this day. Is this day 3 weeks or this day 4 weeks? This day 4 weeks. Yeah. 28. Yeah, it's this day 4 weeks, I think. Yeah. So that's May 4th. Now, let's say before we go for a break, just look at a few comments, because yesterday we spoke about the future of the Irish language. A lovely conversation with Mairéad Ní Mhuinne from Alton. A few of our comments. Colette says, you may learn it, but you should be made to talk it, to have simple books out, not too hard with pictures, just like Cullum did on Highland Radio. Great to have a book in it. And actually, in fairness to Cullum and to Sophie as well, Craxacar, and the work that Cullum is doing on Rula Buila every week. And if there's one thing Cullum gets across week after week on Rula Buila, it's that Irish is a medium through which you can have the best of crack, because you listen to Rula Buila and all you can hear is people having the crack, and long may that continue to be the case. Una says, unfortunately, we don't speak it enough. I don't know if they still play recordings in the Leaving Cert where they ask you questions afterwards on what you listen to. One of my children got the Donegal recording. The other got a recording in Connemara Irish. Now, I've nothing against Connemara Irish. I understand it and it's lovely. My son didn't. I don't know what's the system now, but I think it's only fair if you're from Donegal, it should be Donegal Irish. If you're from Connemara, it should be Connemara Irish.